Hello, I'm sitting with David Eigby, the director of photography on Mad Max, and Chris Murray, the special effects supervisor on Mad Max.
And I'm Tim Ridge, film historian and Mad Max expert.
My name's John Dowding, I'm the art director on Mad Max. And this is the first time we've ever seen the film together in all these years. And I know you're going to enjoy it.
Hi, it's David Eigby here, director of photography. Welcome. It is the first time we've seen the movie. Actually, it's together. It's the first time I've seen the movie in 20 years. So it's going to be quite an interesting ride. I hope you enjoy it with us.
Likewise for me, Chris Murray.
Now, what was that? That was written in Greek, John, on that concrete. What did that actually say? Do you remember?
It was probably a statement about anarchy.
This is near the Yuyang Mountains, just outside of Melbourne. The whole thing is to convey this bleached, arid environment. The lushness of Australia was not captured in this movie. It was all about desolation and not so much post-apocalyptic, but certainly in the future, less inviting and more desolate than today.
George Miller really did extensive location scouting for the film, and so the company moved around a lot while they were shooting.
A great introduction for anybody in a movie is about to unfold before your eyes. John, maybe you want to tell the people what these cars were really like.
Well, I think they'd be lucky if they could do 60 miles an hour, but we managed to make it look like they did. And it was quite often the case that, as I think you said before, the paint was drying on them just before we shot. But hey, they looked the part.
They only actually had 3 police cars for the movie, and of course the 2 black interceptors.
I think we were actually changing the wheels over from vehicle to vehicle because we only had a certain amount of mag wheels.
Now this car is actually an ex-Melbourne taxi.
I remember this sequence pretty good. This introduces the Knight Rider, who was
Vince Gill and his girlfriend Lulu Pincus.
I can remember sitting there looking through the camera and thinking, what the hell is going on here? I'm sure the Knight Rider was in his own world.
And I remember the suggestion that Lulu had bright red hair, and she took that on board quite readily and thought, oh, great.
Quite readily, is that a play on words?
They're visually very rich and dense characters, aren't they, in Mad Max? They've all got hidden histories.
Yes, and they all read quite clearly, don't they?
Yeah.
Okay, we're coming up to a bit here where, see the shot here? This is me hand-holding a camera with a shotgun held in front of it. Graham Page was driving. Here we are. We're coming up, and we suddenly got this point where we slam on the brakes any second, and we get into a spin, and I had to hand-hold the camera as we did like that spin you're watching now. It was quite exciting, and a lot of G-force on the body. As you can see, we did lots and lots of camera mount shots, and it was all about speed and harsh reality. A lot of improvisation. I'm sure the Knight Rider, Vince Gill, he did a lot of improvising. It's all about improvisation, even the photography.
I think the whole shoot was from all of our points of view.
Here we are in a tracking vehicle that I think was the first vehicle of its sort to be used in Australia. It's actually a tracking vehicle with platforms back and front and a crane. And it enabled us to get a lot of the shots in Mad Max, which were unique to the movie. And that was that low camera to the ground, traveling at high speed with a big wide lens. And there was a lot of it was done at actual speed, 180, 200 kilometres an hour. And uh, these sort of speeds, maybe not that fast, but within 2-3 feet of the vehicles that we were following or ahead of or pursuing. It was certainly exciting footage to shoot, and it showed on the screen.
A lot of faith in the drivers, David.
A lot of faith in the drivers. Probably today you wouldn't get away with half of what we did on Mad Max 1. Fortunately, there were no bad injuries. There were a couple of slight injuries, but you know, the car coming past the camera then would probably be about 6 or 8 inches away from the camera. Well, here we are at a roadhouse just outside of Melbourne. If my memory serves me properly, introduces a wonderful character of the Goose, played by Steve Bisley.
Blonde-haired Steve, out of a bottle for the job, wearing the distinctive leathers of the job at Fat Nancy's Cafe.
Introducing George's highway accident motif that recurs repeatedly throughout the film.
Steve Bisley was actually one of Mel's classmates at NIDA, the National Institute of Dramatic Art.
A little bit of goosism there over the bonnet of a car.
My car, in actual fact. And there go the tow tracks like vultures, anticipating that the chase will end in disaster.
Here he goes. Wonderful takeoff there. Now here we have James McClawson with the beard, the writer of the movie. And guess who that is? This is just outside of Melbourne near Williamstown, I believe. Aha, we're coming up to a sequence here which introduces George Miller's old vehicle. I think they used his old vehicle because they got it for nothing.
You were seen out with him 2 nights ago.
So what?
And this is an elaborate setup for the stunt to come, isn't it, really?
This way.
Here we go, a little
my favourite stunt in the whole film.
This one? Look at the did you see the gaffer tape on the front of the blue car then holding the bumper bar on? There we go, this is George Miller's old bongo van.
Yep.
There he goes, look at that.
Wait.
I think they'd even strip the engine out of it.
Oh, absolutely, it wouldn't have done that. Wouldn't have danced like that otherwise.
It was Grantley behind the wheel, was it? Grant Page?
Yeah, Grant Page did most of the stunt driving. He did a great job. Look at this vehicle, still goes.
And he's just about to do something spectacular with it.
Full of dialogue.
Full ad-lib. John Lee. Pull the leg up an armchair.
Nice smoke, Chris.
What did you put on the wheel to do the smoke there?
I don't think I put anything on the wheel.
Didn't you put oil or a WD-40 or something on it?
Might have done. Can't remember now.
Now, this is me with my face about 6 inches off the asphalt as these cars are about a foot away. A lot of people close their eyes in this sequence, and when I first saw it, it was the art of cinema cutting.
Oh,
great stunt. This is even better. A Knight Rider. Who dropped the bike, do you remember?
Grant.
Grant or George Kovacs?
Oh, I love that.
That was, for those who don't know, that was an Australian telephone box.
A lot of you out there probably don't know this, but the director of Mad Max, George Miller, was a medical doctor before he ever became a film director. Miller had really seen the carnage and the pile-ups firsthand, so I think he found a lot of his inspiration for the film in the experiences he had as a doctor. And when Ruth says here, you'd better send a meat truck, he's actually referring to an ambulance.
The movie so far, the whole opening sequence, the whole build-up of this whole sequence is geared to one thing, and that's this guy here, and to introduce the character of Mad Max. At this stage, has been totally silent and solitary.
Must be one of the most gradual character releases in all of film history.
I am a Knight Rider. I'm a fuel-injected suicide machine.
I love the way the Knight Rider's dialogue comes out over the police radios, because of course he's stolen a police car.
that the Knight Rider has stolen a police car, and it's not just any police car, it's the police interceptor, and the main force patrol are just trying to get it back.
Coming into the beginning of the infamous rocket gag.
Here we are, these low wide-angle lenses, which certainly emphasise the landscape and the asphalt element. All about road.
I'm hotter than a rolling dog. Step right up, Tim, and watch the kid lay down a rubber road. Ride to freedom!
Whether it was conscious or not, these really brightly coloured cars on this washed out landscape work brilliantly.
There's a little element coming up here where I think Chris Murray should go into full detail explaining.
Well, pretty soon that crash is coming up, and we put a military booster rocket in Vince and Lulu's car and replaced them with dummies.
That's the blue one, this one here, these people.
That's the one, yep. And might have been a pretty crazy way to do it, and in the end it all turned out well, but initially we weren't so sure.
This is me risking my life again.
We had two bites at this crash, isn't that right, Chris?
Yeah, we did. The first was the rocket car, and the second we towed the car in and blew everything up.
What went wrong with the rocket? Didn't one misfire or something, and no engine in that lifted the front?
Well, the rocket went fine. Here it comes now. That's one of the great shots. You see the rocket flame? There it is.
Legendary explosion, Chris.
But didn't it end up in a paddock or something the first time, or something? Missed the tankers completely?
Oh, yeah, missed the semi and chased the camera car.
Ended up in the middle of a paddock about half a mile off the road because it misfired, and the actual explosion was a recreation sometime later.
Yeah, a couple of days later we towed it in over a 9-inch log and blew it up, but it was a bold attempt. I don't think military rockets are used in films a lot, but probably for good reason.
I don't know, it takes the fun.
Here we have
Joanne
Samuel, who plays Max's wife in the movie, and Joanne got the part by default. The original leading lady was unfortunately injured in a motorcycle accident about 4 days before we were due to film her for the first time.
Rosie Bailey,
that's correct. And unfortunately, Rosie injured her leg and broke her leg, so she couldn't play the part. But Joanne Samuel came in at the last moment and did a great job. I think Mel still looks the same, don't you? He's hardly changed. Few more lines, but boy, I wish I aged that well.
Don't we all?
He's got the same boyish quality to him, I think.
Yes. This is in a beach house at down the coast of Victoria, Aries Inlet, if I remember correctly.
Yes, that's right.
One of the very few beach houses on the coastal side of the highway on the south coast of Australia.
Yes, it looks completely isolated, doesn't it? Despite that, it's only half a K out of quite a sizable town.
And believe it or not, it's still there, and you can actually rent it for a holiday.
I remember filming a big party scene there. My wife, well, not then, but my nowadays wife, who I'd met just before Mad Max, played a part in the film, and she was hoping it might launch a career.
Yes, I remember people coming in with trombones and...
Yeah, it's a sequence we shot, a big party sequence we shot on the beach house, which never made the final cut. Now, Mel looks about 21, 22 there, and of course he was.
I think the idea of Max's son Sprog playing with a gun here is brilliant. It just gives you the impression that danger is always present.
Whose baby was it, do you remember?
Get out of here.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, John, but people actually think that's leather he's wearing. But if I remember, it was actually vinyl, because we couldn't afford to make real leather costumes?
Well, I'm not sure. Well, I've got a feeling that most of the cops wore vinyl, but I think Max might have been the only guy who did actually wear leather.
Maybe the Goose too, but I can remember constantly mentioning to the wardrobe that the you could see the white vinyl showing through the leatherette look on all the stitching.
That's right, and often the vinyl would rip quite easily, particularly on the larger actors, and needed constant repair.
Halls of Justice. This is the Spotswood Power Sewer, an old sewerage pumping station just outside of Melbourne.
That's right.
Wonderful old location.
Now, a block of condos, John, you said?
Yes, more than likely a block of condos. We split this location with some other places, and Odysseus Gasworks, I remember.
And was it also the Melbourne Uni car park, which we were saying is underneath?
Which is where we are now, yes.
This is Melbourne University car park, and this introduced one of the other stars of the movie, which was the Black on Black, which was, here we are, this is coming up, the ultimate police car, which was a GT Ford Falcon, a GDHO, which had, even stock was a very fast motor car, and of course it's tricked out. John, you might want to give a few details. I know Chris probably got involved in all the turbocharging effect, but it was certainly the other hero of the film.
Yes, it was magnificent. I'm not sure how mechanically sound all the engineering is. It looks impressive, though, and it sounds fantastic.
He's in a car over there!
Spent many hours in it being flung around.
Funny how both the second principal lead and the stunt coordinator were both in a cast at the time.
Now you see those other two police cars there. You think there's a whole fleet of police cars. They're actually the other ones. And then we moved around to the background of that shot. It's sort of we haven't got a heap of cars, but we utilise them many, many times.
When do we go for a ride?
Roger Ward playing Fifi McCaffey, and Jonathan Harvey, who plays the police commissioner, two wonderful Australian actors.
Police commissioner is on just a break from his taekwondo exercises. Fantastic notion.
Gives you the distinct impression that he's not too popular down at the Halls of Justice.
Now this is, again, the Spotswood pumping station. We're up in the tower rooms. That's why they're such tiny rooms and little narrow stairwells built in the 20s.
That's right, but it gave us fantastic dynamic.
That's wonderful. Now, for those who will notice, there's a little spider. Look at that great shot. Wonderful shot. There's a spider actually tattooed on the top of the Roger Ward's head. Now, this is the beginning or the entrance to the Westgate Freeway in Melbourne. Before that actually opened the bridge, and I remember clearly renting in a couple of HMI lights to light this scene because we didn't have a lot of big lighting equipment on this movie. We actually had to rent it in just to light this scene. Now, to me, it seemed enormous at the time, but when I look back now, it's not a large area that we lit, but it's a fairly graphic scene.
Viv Mefon's makeup?
Viv Mefon, yes. Makeup artist extraordinaire. Got all these tow trucks in. I'm sure everybody just got a slab of beer and $20 for turning up.
They did indeed, and I also remember the ambulance got sent back with the decal that I'd invented. It was borrowed from the ambulance department for, again, a slab of beer, and sent back to the ambulance department with our new decal on it.
Hey, good boy. Hey. Come on.
This scene is electrifying. I remember the day it sort of... these 200 or 100 motorcycles came in, and Hugh Keysburn, who played the tow cutter, the head biker, certainly ran the roost here. And I remember all these motorcycles coming into town and revving up, and they all reverse, as you can see, they're about to reverse into the gutter. They all sit up there, and he revs up the engines and signals them to all shut off at the same time. The hairs are standing up on the back of your neck.
It's all with military precision.
It's wonderful, you know, and And a lot of these guys had just met that day, you know.
Which town was this?
Clunes. It's a small, sleepy country town southwest of Melbourne. It definitely has a western frontier feel about it.
One of the unique things about Mad Max, which should be mentioned, is that the principal actors, the main biker gang, the actors, were all sent their motorcycles about a month before we started filming. So by the time they all arrived on the set, they were already an established gang. And you can even see Hugh there. His right eyebrow is shaved off. It's called troweling or some terminology, which he decides to do. It's just this little twist, these little elements that just change the whole thing. But they were certainly a gang of their own by the time they got to Melbourne.
What a well-cast mob, eh?
Look, it was just the right group of people at the right time. Tim Burns, who plays Jimmy the Boy.
Yeah.
Hugh Keysburn in the lead there. That was handheld, by the way. It was me hand-holding the camera. No such luxury as steady cams and dollies.
What are those inflatables, John?
Oh, they're just sort of straight inflatables. What interests me here is that you've got Reg Evans, who plays the station master, who's also the garage keeper, and Hugh Keysburn, and I think the guy who plays Bubba, and I can't remember his name.
That's Jeff Parry.
All Shakespearean actors.
Yep.
Point to take note of that we have this group of trained Shakespearean actors, which are on the platform as you see it now, thrown in amongst a group of authentic real bikers.
The Vigilantes.
The Vigilantes and various others, and at one stage the Hells Angels, that seem to have a common understanding of one another and fitted in very well.
Entirely.
That's what I meant. Poor bastard.
Good night. It's we were mentioning before how Hugh Keysburn, the toe cutter, almost came out with a different accent every day and or a different performance level that's varied. And it reminds us very strongly of Marlon Brando in Missouri Breaks, who every performance, every scene just about had some different accent and different expression and different wardrobe.
What a magnificent actor Hugh he is, eh? He's really something else.
Yes, I tend to agree.
Absolutely. And he seemed to inspire everybody around him, whether it was fellow actors or other technicians.
And Tim Burns, we have Tim Burns just standing next to him, who plays Johnny the Boy.
Yep.
Take him away.
There he is on the right of screen there, very young-looking Tim Burns, another great Australian actor.
Baba. Johnny.
This is the so-called of wanting a private moment with a rather small coffin that contains the remains of the Knight Rider. Now, here we are. This is commonly known as doing a donut. And this guy is one of the vigilantes, if I remember rightly, and it's his own motorcycle. And I might add that I remember seeing one of these donuts at the corner of Swanson Street and Flinders Street in Melbourne. During the making of Mad Max, and I'm not sure who, but somebody on the film did it.
David Brex with a drinking straw.
Playing Mudguts.
That's right.
And the guy in the red leather is?
Kundalini.
Played by?
Paul Johnston. Introducing Kundalini.
Now this, I must admit, this scene in Mad Max is probably, I think, the most violent scene. What follows here is not seen, but in insinuated violence. Although that's not too calm, is it? That's the stirrup drag. Was that Grant Page being dragged there?
I think so.
Similar to the old stirrup drags in the westerns, they sit them on a leather plate and drag them down the street. Now, this is a wonderful car. Didn't the exhaust pipes on the bonnet pop off during that shot?
Oh, they kept falling off, yeah, and we had this weird figurehead on the front that kept falling off too.
And just a bit more glue and stick it on.
Remember that Byron didn't have enough money to make a break or glass window to chuck the bloke through, so he came out through the door.
That's right, yeah. Well, we did make the door, yes.
I think you did a brilliant job on the inside of this car, John. I mean, the whole thing is just wall-to-wall fur.
Now, this is a fairly graphic scene. I think the imagery of this scene was used as the promo on Mad Max. And now, this is an undercrank shot. You can tell by the staggered movement that we undercranked that a little bit. That meant we slowed the camera down so it looked fast on the screen. Now, this is all shot hand, camera mounts and handheld inside the car, and it's all shot very crudely, but very effectively.
Extremely effectively. And this is real glass breaking, real metal being broken.
Real cameraman inside the car hand holding.
Exactly. Real axes.
No breakaways?
No, nothing made of rubber. A brave job, though.
Now, they're those exhaust pipes.
Yeah, easy to knock off.
I don't think they repaired this car after, did they?
No, I mean, nowadays you think, oh, I saw this the other day and I thought, hey, what is that? You know, a 67...
It's a Ford Fairlane. That's
an incredible montage, isn't it? It's kind of frenzied montage of destruction. It's incredibly well done and quite horrific, isn't it, really?
Another shot here. Just remember who directed Violence in the Cinema Part 1 and 2.
That's for sure.
I think that this scene was actually cut in either, I think it was France or England when the film was released. They basically just cut just after the hatchet first comes down on the roof of the car.
What about that weird, weird bike, John?
It looks strangely Baroque in that environment, doesn't it? But it's a late 70s icon, which I suppose is an extension of the bike culture.
Does Baroque mean it's not running?
A wonderful machine. A chopped tricycle.
It's always fascinating how you get squealing wheels on tyre on dirt road.
Okay, we're gone. Hey, Max, see looks.
Yep.
Hey, fella, hey, stop! Hey, fella! Hey, fella, stop! What a
touch. Remember Viv dribbling glycerine down his buttocks?
Yes, glycerine and a bit of movie blood, I think.
Here's the aftermath of the toe cutter gang's attack on the Chev, signaled by signatory Donut on the road.
Johnny the Boy, Tim Burns.
Despite the fact that the bike gang did a very good job in destroying the car during filming of the attack sequence, we nonetheless had to go in and open it up like a tin can and rip the roof lining out and the chairs and to give the effect of the violence that had been perpetrated. The aftermath damage really tells the story, and it's so horrifying.
Very graphic imagery. Very graphic. A young woman, never acted before, I believe.
Wrapping herself in one of the car seat covers.
Adam, he's gone, man. He ain't never come back. Woo! Oh, this is it. The man's come for
it. Ah, wonderful composition.
It's all right.
You know, that format certainly lends itself to these sort of shots.
That's the Todeo format.
Well, it's a cinemascope format, you know, the 2.35:1 anamorphic lenses, but...
And everything's going to be all right.
I still don't get why Johnny the Boy wasn't taken away by the gang.
So the only thing that comes to mind that maybe he returned, maybe he's too rebellious or for the gang, because throughout the film he is reprimanded often by the toe cutter, you know, as the young rebellious gang member that just won't conform, you know.
Certainly too impulsive for the rest of them.
Being such stolid conservative gang members.
True.
Now, this is obviously an undercrank shot. Again, the camera is slightly slowed down to make the image look a bit faster. We didn't do it very often in the film, but occasionally we did it. This is Jeff Parry playing Bubba Zanetti.
And Hugh Keyes Burns sitting in Byron Kennedy, the producer's office chair, which he had to do with for a day or two, whilst we had it in the back of the truck.
We are going to teach him, Baba. You are going back for him.
No way. Not me, not
for him. Another different accent? I'm not sure.
Yes, a bit of English there. Hugh's native English coming through.
Wasting your time, the snag on race! He's nothing like a knife rider!
Bubba Zanetti was the only one who didn't take the muffler off his motorcycle. Now, this is the old disused gasworks in Port Melbourne, playing as the police headquarters.
Interesting choice to have the police station based out of a sewerage processing factory.
Nobody seemed to bother to straighten the portrait of the Queen. Or file the records, it seems.
A few bare bulbs.
Quite a lot of bare bulbs and wonderful shadows and depicting an organisation that's simply beyond organisation.
Hey, Lisa. What happened to the car?
What do you think?
It's a wonderful scene that's just about to come up with the lawyers.
Perhaps it's the result of an anxiety.
Yeah, this is one of my favourite scenes in the film, coming up where the lawyers actually get the release of Johnny the Boy, and I think Steve Bisley, here we have John Lee with his voice amplified, because his throat was damaged in the sequence earlier. But I thought Steve Bisley did a great job in the scene.
It's a shame we don't see more of John Lee anymore.
Yeah.
What are you so scared? Got no place.
Whose idea was it? Is that George?
That's George.
The medical side?
Yeah. Anything slightly warped physically would be George's idea.
A lot of handheld in this scene. And no camera.
I love Johnny the Boy's suit.
Yeah.
Well, he'd just been to court, I guess. You know.
And he's borrowed it from somebody. It's too tight. And I love the way his tie's gone as well.
The lawyers are fabulous.
Hey, mate, what's going on?
Let him go, guys!
Let him go, hey!
Who's this? Keep out of what's going on.
No one should, okay?
Forget it, Charlie. Just let him go.
Forget it, Charlie. Just let him go.
No one should.
No. What? What's
the... Now, here we have a scene where Steve, Bisley and Mel Gibson are disagreeing about an element of the fact that Johnny the Boy is about to be released. And Mel Gibson and Steve Bisley were at NIDA acting school together and graduated the same year.
Jesus Christ, you're not going to let him walk out the door, Fifi.
That's exactly what you're going to do.
Shut up. Oh, keep on, Charlie. Keep going. Come on, it's all right. Cool, all right.
Handheld camera just to heighten the urgency of the scene. Very well, we're a very well acted scene, I think. The
court will hear about this, I promise. And wonderful to see these lawyers in this dung heap of a police station, which was literally full of
This is for real. This is almost for real.
Yeah, it is. I remember them restraining each other.
Steve and Mel got into it. They did a great job. And also Tim Burns.
Stop walking out that door. Get him out of here.
It's quite a violent scene played entirely without stunts or anything like that.
See you later, Goose. It's been a pleasure.
No stunt doubles. Actors doing it themselves. I do remember this sequence from a cinematographer's point of view. It was a large courtyard with very high walls each side, and we had one day to shoot. And as you will see, the shadows are getting longer and longer. And by the time the scene was finished at the end of the day, I think there was about 6 inches of sunlight left in the courtyard.
Do you remember which the last shot of the sequence was? Maybe this one.
Now there's the Westgate Bridge in the background, which had not yet been opened.
Is that your black plastic there, John?
More than likely. Probably hiding something we didn't want to see, or just giving the illusion of something derelict. Ah.
Another favourite. This introduces polystyrene.
That's right.
Who is the mannequin that they just pulled off the back of the motorbike. There she is.
She needed quite a lot of repainting before appearing on screen.
Very graphic imagery. Very stark.
Davy Brax.
Who plays Mudguts.
Whose relative is Premier of Victoria.
Stephen Brax.
Mudguts! Get out of there.
A lot of these elements of wardrobe and props and a lot was brought on by the individual actors. I think they certainly played the part and lived the part. They didn't get out of it at the end of the day. There was no get out of your costume and go home and put on your shorts and your T-shirt. These guys lived these characters for a month before the film and during filming, and probably some of them for many years after.
That's right. Now, there was no handing the costume back in at the end of the day. And there's a thing, Chris.
We actually shot it, if I remember.
Yes, we did.
No movie charges.
No, it was a shotgun.
Frankly, it's the easiest way to do it, isn't it?
Well, yes.
Well, but you're not allowed to anymore.
I know.
No, but when you're looking out to sea, I mean, what are you going to shoot apart from polystyrene?
Oh, dear. Put your finger
shocking.
In you.
Absolutely shocking.
Well, it seems so pragmatic to me.
It's extremely practical.
I've always loved this sequence, David, the way you just dealt with this, and we just face off straight into the sun and they disappear into this bleached
environment. Well, you go with it. End of the day, the sun was very low, and just record it, just go with it. You know, you speak to Tim Burns, who plays Johnny the Boy, he describes how the roof of his mouth was
scored
and shredded for days after with the...
It's a great shot. Look at it.
It's marvellous.
Wonderful. Look at that.
And you know they're going off to have a long Sugar talk about everything. Reality.
Now, this is a little sequence that I've been asked about many times. This is a nightclub in South Yarra in Melbourne. I forget the name of the nightclub, but I think, John, you gave us the... was the illuminated floor there, or did you provide that?
I'm pretty sure it was there, David. Given the budget, I think it must have been there.
It was an interesting location. I like that. And this is one of the few times I was able to use fog filters and fog. here we have Johnny the Boy fixing the Goose's motorbike.
Very atmospheric. This is a very seductive scene. Nice to do a nightclub scene which doesn't have flashing lights.
No, this is Robina Chappie.
Robina Chappie.
Playing the singer. Very sultry looking woman.
This scene always reminded me of something out of Blade Runner. It's a very Blade Runner sort of sequence, you know. Now, the next scene, next sequence shot, was basically a shot coming up, is one of my, leading up to the bedroom scene the morning after, is one of my favourite shots in the movie. A little bit of halation there on the window. It's a bit of fog filter, it just sort of tells the story very well.
It's got a real morning after feel about it. And this surprising thing on the door that...
John.
That was John Lee was standby props at the time, and he
who played one of the policemen, of course.
He played Charlie, who copped the saucepan in his throat. And he said, "John, wait till you see the rushes. I think you really enjoy this sequence."
Here we go, turning on the fact that the gear change starts the motorbike. By the way, I still rode motorcycles most weekends, and I can tell you, for any biker that watches that, he's totally blown away.
Well, as it says at the beginning, a few years from now.
Now, I think this is Terry Gibson, or the Pie Man, who was the head biker of the Vigilantes at the time. I'm pretty sure he did most of the Goose's riding. He was certainly riding the motorcycle for a shot that's coming up, which I'd like to describe as it happens.
There's Tim Burns, Johnny the Boy, sitting inside my old car.
Burning himself.
Burning himself, seeing what it's going to feel like.
Just shows how crazy the guy really is.
This is a great shot. Now, here we are about 2 inches. We're sitting right on the asphalt here. And here comes the motorcycle, which is literally about 8 inches from the camera. Great cut there. You know, using the frame as a proscenium arch, basically. Here we are on the tracking vehicle, low, very low to the ground, travelling at about 100, 120 kilometres an hour. Wide lens really accentuates the speed. Now this shot here, now this is a shot I did handheld on the back of a motorbike. Now if you look, the speedometer's at 180 kilometres an hour, I think it is, or thereabouts, it's or 160, it's really rocketing along, and I'm handheld, and Terry Gibson was riding the bike leaning over, and I'm sort of... holding this camera, just leaning on his back, using the windbreak from the tiny windshield. And
what sort of camera was it, Dan?
It was a BL, quite a heavy camera.
Mm.
But it was the only way to get the shot, because otherwise, if you'd have fixed the camera here you go. If you'd have fixed the camera to the bike, it would have gone over, and the horizon wouldn't have stayed horizontal, you know. This is a shot I remember where I asked the stunt guy, George Kovacs, where the bike was going to land, and it wasn't quite exactly where he said. It landed about 2 feet from the camera. All these motorcycles were donated by Kawasaki, weren't they, John? Z1000?
They were indeed. They were effectively ours to do what we liked with. We could decorate them, treat them, re-engineer them as we wanted to.
And, you know, in those days there were big motorcycles and there were 1,000cc Quakers. You know, they were a fairly fast motorcycle, a production vehicle, production motorcycle that was released by Kawasaki. Now, my memory is we lost a day filming with this vehicle.
We did, and that was because we had two of these vehicles.
And what happened? They both didn't go, or they both broke down, or...?
No, what happened was that, I remember this, we had two of these, so what we call sort of underwater swamp vehicles, prepared. It's the only occasion that we had two of anything. And the wrong vehicle got sent out to do the stunt that we're just about to see. And it didn't have the engine power or the torque to do the stunt.
Well, this would have to be the slowest tracking shot we did in the whole movie.
Yes, it would.
Now, I remember this, Johnny, the Johnny Boy, it was like so... I was in the car handheld when we did the insert of the wheel hitting... Now, here we have a situation where whether it's intentional or unintentional, you have the prettiness of the Victorian countryside, probably as a parchment for what is one of the most graphically violent scenes in the movie, where you have blue skies and wispy clouds and farmland, and which is the environment for what is a very ghastly deed. You know, Stu Bisley spent many, many moments hanging upside down. You can tell by his eyes being so red, even though it's coloured water dripping down, it was in his face. It was a very uncomfortable scene for Steve to do. A very well-performed scene by Tim and Hugh.
Moment,
you know, when the young one is confronted with the truth and the
implacable evil of his gang leader.
Yes. You know, we mentioned Shakespearean actors before, and you almost need somebody of that magnitude to play. Look at Hugh. Look how intense he is, and Tim. It's just, boy, they're such great actors. They really haven't been, I think, recognised and rewarded for what they contributed to this film. This is in a real hospital in Kew in Melbourne. Available light, if I remember rightly, we just shot with what was there. I might have had a few lights through the doorways. This particular scene where is graphically portrayed by simply putting a bare bowl underneath the sheets with it actually wasn't Steve Bisley under there, but it was somebody that was in some graphic position. Again, the George Miller's medical expertise was very very strong in these visions.
The hand actually belonged to the actress who played Mae Swasey.
Oh, the older woman. You know, here the sound effect is great here, the breathing apparatus. You know, this is Mad Max seeing his best buddy. We obviously, and what's strong is about it, we don't see it. You know, that's probably stronger than actually physically showing it.
Because the hand sets up the horror of the vision.
Yeah, and the shadow and his reaction and...
Max! Hey, Max!
That thing in there. That's not the goose. No way.
So, you know, that sequence basically sets up the rest of the film.
Now it's Shakespearean, it's revenge.
No, that's, exactly, it's revenge. And that shot where Mel sat up, that was actually, I think I cut up a shoebox and put a slit in a cardboard shoebox and Mel sat up into a slash of light across his eyes. I must admit I've used it a few times since.
It's a winner. Here we are back at the wonderful, apparently isolated beach house.
I love the way that the movie can move back and forth pretty fluidly between the really fast cut action and stunt sequences and the more traditional character-driven shots.
What's that structure in the background, John?
Well, it's just a chair with some bamboo poles and something that'll move in the wind to give a bit of kinetic to the sequence. And to counterpoint one of the more... quieter moments in the film that just balances the rest of the frenetic action of the story and gives us a pause before the film takes off at another great rate and time to think.
It's quite well structured, really, isn't it?
It gives us time to digest what's been going on before and give us fuel for what's going to come.
Here I am.
The more you see this picture, it's funny that there's barely a wasted frame, isn't there? It's very spare.
I'll be all right once I get it clear of my head.
Yes, I agree. Now, this is a wonderful scene between Roger Ward, Fifi McAfee, and obviously Mel playing Mad Max, where Mel wants to resign from the police force. And Roger telling him he'll be back.
Roger had his head shaved for this part, but by the same token, we had decided to put a spider tattoo on the back of his head, and every time he was on set I would draw it on his head with a Nikko pen, and his scalp was extremely sensitive, so it became increasingly difficult to draw this tattoo on.
Now, Roger was, as you can see, he's a very big man, and in his early years was a wrestler, I believe. And he still maintained his fitness. This is again the Spotswood pumping station, I believe.
That's right, yeah.
A wonderful location, which had not been used for many years, and was pretty run down and built in the Victorian era. This lovely spiral staircase, which just lended itself to great imagery.
That's right. All the windows all seemed to be in the right place, didn't they? And the texture on the walls and... We did.
What's that sort of necklacey thing under Roger's, well, whatever it is, his kind of...
His cravat. I don't know. It's just a whole bunch of gold chains, I think.
Okay, and his nice plastic watering can.
Yes, because he loves his plant.
Yeah. He is in touch with his sensitive side.
He's a wonderful character, Roger.
You still feel the same way when you come back? Well, it's okay by me.
Come on. I'm not going to change my mind.
Get out of here, you're going to try to come with you, huh?
That's really nice, David, the way you've got Max, but Max's shadow that follows after him.
A little choice, there's only one place to put the light, John.
I know, but, you know,
in the stairwell, you...
cinema history in the making.
In the stairwell, you put the light in one spot where you can't see it, you know. I love this, the fact we cut to this bleak, arid environment. It's a strong cut.
And a bright red car. Always works.
And this shows a bit more of country Australia in a pleasant way. You know, it's a young family. He's resigned from the police force, or he's on leave of absence. And they're just out doing their thing. You know, a happy married couple. Another lull before the storm.
Yeah, it's lovely. And here's a... For once in a while, a real member of the public.
Juxtaposed against industrial landscapes. Yeah, which I think is an important issue. You know, we never actually fully escape from it, do we? He's got a really cheesy graphics on his van. Hasn't he? Space graphics on his van?
Very much of the time. That's probably one of the few things that really locates us in the time when we made the film.
Wasn't this at, I can forget where that was, actually, that water sequence?
I can't remember. It feels like it was just the north of Melbourne there, on the river.
Guess I always counted on you understanding.
And here again, Mel shows us that he can also change gear and display some nice, sensitive acting moments. And it's also great to slow the pace down and take a break from all the action.
This is an incredibly quiet moment compared to the action that we've been seeing.
I suppose Mel's nipple's worth a lot more than it was then.
I don't know. You were probably aware of that at the time, weren't you, Dave?
I was looking at Joanne.
So would I have been. It takes its time. It takes the time that it deserves.
Trying to keep up with it. I can't think.
I think I was busy testing fireballs when all this was being shot.
The life of a special effects supervisor. Pyro.
I seem to recall one of those tests, Chris, where I was driving up the main north road out of Melbourne. And
gosh, this is a very moving moment. You're talking about explosions.
And seeing the top blow off.
Where's your sensitivity?
Well, I'm not paid for my sensitivity.
I don't want to wait 10 years to tell you how I'm feeling about you right now. Do you know what?
Ah. This is a great location. A car yard we happened to chance across that looked like it could come from the beach, and it's just full of so many cars you just simply wouldn't believe.
You bend them, we mend them.
Yeah. There's a lot of Johnisms here, isn't there?
A lot of Johnisms. You can't smell it, you can't eat it.
That's right.
Get a lot of that.
Yeah, we had a blowout a while back. Raunchy, very raunchy. What's a donk like?
Yeah, the donk's fine. Look, about this.
A lot of you are probably wondering what a donk is. It's just another example of Australian slang. It means simply an engine.
How about this tire, huh? Have a 69 time. I can sell you a set of lights.
This character's wonderful. The grease monkey, he's called in the script.
He's a great actor, too. What's he?
Nick Lathouris.
Nick Lathouris, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes. I've worked with him a few times.
Yeah.
A couple of times since.
He's tremendous. I remember pouring a bucket of oil over him, basically, to get him to look like that.
I think, what the molly F, there's a word in there, what the molly...
Molly frock.
Molly frock, I can't say the word, but what the molly F are you doing? That's a scene that comes later on when Mel comes back and releases the jack that he's on, of the vehicle that he's laying under. And Joanna, he's about to stay and get the flat tire. I'm not quite sure why he stayed, but... Joanne is about to go off and
confront the gang.
Yeah.
Oh, at a milk bar.
I kept saying Joanne. In actual fact, her character name is Jessie Rokitansky. Now, this is a very unique place that not many people know about, not far out of Melbourne, called Avalon Beach. And it's a beach community from the 40s, the 50s, that is hidden away. It's just an amazing environment with all these old beach houses right on the water.
Still the same?
I believe so.
Still the same.
Now, this is a sequence that it starts to build again. It's interesting, the structure, how we go into the lows, and then bit by bit we start to...
But see this background action over in the on the right there? There are people just exercising. And
But I'm sure that was their own improvisation.
Absolutely. And all this stuff... From the milk bar, I actually removed from my local milk bar at 5 o'clock in the morning. Brought it down to set in the back of the ute, and then the following morning I took it back.
There's a sequence coming up where is it Kundalini? Whose arm gets ripped off? I forget who. Kundalini's wraps the chain around the pack rack and rips his hand off and. And I remember in Russia's, no, it went on, and nobody actually picked it. You could pick somebody's hand up there, holding onto the pack rack, sort of the things you get through in filmmaking.
Choco to get it in the nuts.
Nothing worse than a vanilla ice cream in the face.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's just a... Here we go.
There we are.
And
zip. Kundalini's hand. Who was that? Who was the stunt here today?
That would have been Paul, I think.
You must have spent some point. Like the sign says, three's just a question of money. How far do you want to go?
Wait, wait, get in!
What's wrong?
Just take my word for it, get in!
No, what about the tire?
Please, Max!
There's a tire, man!
Again, we have a musical score, which is very classical and
very lush,
and embellish for such an action piece. I guess the contrast, the extremes of contrast in the film, in the performance, in the imagery, is also enhanced by the extremes in the music. You know, there are scenes with nothing, or this high classical score.
They left a goddamn spear, not a bad one either.
Who are they?
A couple.
Passing through.
Said they were heading north, maybe.
Again, that would have been Hugh's improvisation to grab hold of Nicola Furis's nose like that.
Probably didn't tell Nick either.
Did you see it? You've got to grab it.
It's like a signpost.
Exactly. Sorry, Nick.
Well, I can still see his face now. Looks as if he just swallowed a
brick. What a mean old lady you are. Huh, boss?
Nothing, you mate.
Oh.
This was during the era of sin bins, they called them. Everybody had a sin bin, and it was a panel van with some imagery painted on the...
Here's the hand.
Here's the hand.
Yes. A $5 joke shop hand and a 60-cent shank of pork.
To attract the dog.
Gary Day.
Hmm. He's going to place the hand with somebody who cares. George was going to use a guy with no face, but sort of chickened out at the last minute.
Now, is this a family friend or something?
I suspect so.
If no one makes a claim to it, I say we can forget it.
Sounds okay to me, Jess.
No.
If Ziggy says so, believe me.
The music's pretty...
May's expecting out of the
pretty lush and insistent now, isn't it?
Something's building. The violins are
getting
pretty violent there. Now, I remember this location, John, but I don't remember where it was at. Tell us.
It's about 20 miles north of Melbourne. The main road north just veers slightly to the right, and there's this large hill ahead of you. And there is, on top of which, is this large clump of fir trees and this old homestead. It's there to this day, and I remember driving up towards that one day, and the top of the hill blew off, and when I got there, I realized it blew off with a giant fireball, that is, and when I got there, I found Chris Murray, who's sitting just next to me, and Chris was doing a test for a scene later on in the movie.
There's a few fireballs, if I remember.
I'll see you with those hands, and I'll rip you apart. Look at them. No.
But this was a wonderful environment.
I think it's still there and is possibly used as a horse stud farm.
Quite wonderful. I'm getting a little peaceful moment that is underscored with immense threat.
But again, no music. It's interesting that the romantic scenes or the intimate scenes have no underscore of music. The music is left for the building of the scenes that are become exciting. I've never noticed that before.
Mm.
You think this would be a magic moment for music?
Oi. Yes.
Oh, hang on. As I mentioned that, a bit of music comes on.
This is the theme that Jesse plays on the saxophone at the beginning. It's
Jesse's theme?
Jesse's theme,
She didn't play it.
No, but I always like to think Joanne could play the saxophone.
Here we have
Jesse.
Mae Swayze, played by Sheila Florence.
And she of Prisoner fame for many years.
Yes, a very popular show in Australia, Prisoner, and England, I believe. We did very well in England. Only second to Neighbours.
Wonderful actress.
Yeah.
Notice how Mae is wearing these calipers, those braces on her legs. George was so into the idea of everyone having some kind of handicap. It was probably inspired again by his medical background.
Well, it was an idea that we, wherever we could, we'd come up with giving people physical deformations. And so Sheila ended up wearing the calipers, but if you recall, it led to a dreadful accident because she fell into a rabbit hole or something.
Broke her leg.
Broke her leg.
Now, this is a great sequence. This is typical classic movie making where...
This is Hitchcock.
It is. It was very, very cleverly done and conceived. It's just walking down to a beach and what you see is a very pleasant environment can turn into a very threatening environment. This is down, I believe, near Black Rock or that area in Victoria. Down in the bay, Melbourne Bay.
Yes.
Port Phillip Bay. I remember Joanne kept falling out of that bathing costume. She wasn't that happy about it.
This is lovely. A dog covered in sand. It's just so real, you know?
Yeah. Good use of seagulls there.
With a few crows mixed in.
Again, absolutely no music.
Which leads you to think that something dreadful is going to happen.
Yeah, now we're heading back through that, what initially was a very inviting location with no threat, and it was suddenly turned into a really, very threatening environment.
Did you like this, David? I noticed the tree shadows on Joanna being quite...
Yeah, I would have had a bit of fill light on her there. Mm. It's just a little bit hard to get away from sometimes.
No, but it works really well because the shadows falling across the body are good.
The subliminal cuts.
And the music again.
Yep. By the look of it, I'd say the shots of Joanne and those shots were done on a separate day. Oh no, we've got sun out now.
I think you just had one day there from memory. And while you were doing that...
You were dressing the fan, huh?
I was actually making a dead dog.
There's the dog.
Tell us about the dog, John.
Oh, well, the dog, I think, just arrived on set in time, and that was modelled on my own dog.
Maxie Fairchild, who played the character of Benno, the mentally impaired son of May Swayze.
I love that big gap in the back of Max's pants, like May Swayze had. Has just fixed them as he's grown.
Might add that Maxie Fairchild, apart from Mel Gibson, was the only other actor that appeared in Mad Max 2.
Really?
Yep. He was tied to the front of one of the vehicles, if I remember, early on in the film, and was put out of his misery suddenly.
Right.
Come on, darling. Come on, Jesse. Well, let's go into the house.
Well, Florence, eh?
You had an awful time, darling.
John, where was this? Was this inside the farmhouse?
This is actually inside the real farmhouse. Yeah. Beautiful, classic Australian homestead with huge windows.
I thought the house was abandoned. Isn't the house empty?
We must have dressed it in that case.
I don't know. My recollection is the house was abandoned and you put all that in. Isn't that from your lounge room?
Probably. Oh, yes, I do remember the throne. But I'm just astonished at the amount of stuff that we all have managed to do in the space of time, given the money.
Well, the one thing I remember was having quite a long shoot for a film in 1977-78. If I remember, it was like 11 or 12 week shoot, which was unheard of.
It's huge, wasn't it?
That's right.
Didn't mean we had any more money. We just had more time to do it.
And also, we were able to go from one side of Melbourne to the other.
Yes.
Out to Clunes, to small villages and so forth, and without consideration for the time it would take off the production. And that was wonderful.
Yep.
Except because of less traffic.
It probably was, but people don't do that nowadays.
No.
They want... We were very, you know, everybody was very concerned about the look and then and the feeling of it.
There's a great shot coming up, which is all the bike.
That's the one.
Yeah.
It's our little mother.
From the kid.
Look at that.
Yeah.
At Mudguts, Davey breaks up on the...
He breaks up there.
I think that was his idea, to suspend himself from the brick wall.
But he did that constantly as a human sculpture.
Oh, dear. It's almost sort of a Japanese samurai warrior, Kurosawa sort of looking imagery with his hand there.
You've not got a sense of...
Now we enter the Scottish accent.
Scottish accent. Just the best fun these guys had.
Oh, they were so clever, really, when you think about it.
You don't need a sense of humour with a pretty face.
Now, what is that little mark on Hugh's face there? Do you should...
There's a little tattoo we invented for them, which, frankly, in the upshot, became irrelevant.
Yes.
What do you want from me?
It was meant to ID the gang, but hell, with characters like this, did we need to identify?
Oh, no, this is great, mate.
Yeah. I hate guns.
I hate guns. Stand back. Stay back.
Woman.
Stay back.
What happened there, Chris?
Real shotgun, real drum, real water. No bullet hits.
My God, just wait till I tell workplace health and safety about that.
Indeed. We tested it before, so we knew the pellets wouldn't go through the drum.
Here we have Kundalini with no hand.
Elephants.
A real baby crying.
And Mae Swayze walking in calipers but with a damaged leg.
Yes.
And here,
constantly taunting the bikers.
I should have given them a proper breakaway door, but all I did was loosen a few bits and pieces, and it took the force of all eight of them to break the door down.
I'll tell you, if anybody could have broken the door down, it would have been that group.
I know. They did very well, and it looked great.
Okay. Actually, that looks like a real brick being kicked out there.
It really was. Bang. The gate was broken away, that wasn't it?
Yes, unfortunately.
Look at that. That's not fake. That's real wood.
Yes. I wish the gate had been...
Max and Benny, late as ever. They're always late, these guys. They never turn up on time.
We have a lump of fence or gateway impaled in the radiator of the vehicle, which...
And some Payne's Wessex smoke under the bonnet.
Is that what it was?
And a very nice dripping effect, Chris.
Beautiful stuff, Chris.
Mm. This is a horrendous sequence.
It is. It's sort of, again, insinuated and not seen, but, boy, it's pretty horrible.
I remember reading somewhere, sometime before this, that in most road accidents, it's the case that people's shoes fly off.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why we see something we see in a moment.
Mm.
But the idea of actually... putting in the rev counter into that shot sequence is extraordinary.
Oh, the shoe and the ball, so it says it all, doesn't it? So,
yeah.
And the bits of, see the bits of asphalt that are melted off the road. And
And then you listen to the soundtrack and you just hear the crows cawing right at the very end of that shot.
Mm-hmm. Again, here we have the music. The music is... very dramatic, but and there's no reality with distance and time, and you know the fact that they got there in a given time is inconceivable. But you don't care because you're in the moment of the scene. How far one has to run, travel is irrelevant. It's all about the moment. And you didn't need close-ups there. Cut to the black clouds, the highway, the ambulance. It's so well structured. here we have Joanne. We're insinuating she has one arm missing and broken arms and legs. And the guy on the right there, Peter Felmingham, who played the doctor, was actually an instructor in basic training for me when I joined the Navy. Turned up on the set one day as an actor.
He didn't want to give you instruction, did he?
No, I was in a position to instruct him for one.
Perfect.
Was he still in the Navy?
No, he was in civilian life, but he was a good guy. I remember he was a good guy. The lighting was all about tragedy, you know, and it was very, very designed in the way that, you know, under lighting and just lighting what was needed to be seen, you know. Yeah, the lensing was pretty important in Mad Max, and utilising the format and the lensing was a major part of the film. And here we have a sequence where Max is contemplating, again, revenge, as he did once before with his friend, the Goose, a man in turmoil. And he seeks revenge. It's the samurai warrior out to revenge his friend and his wife and his son, and here he is. Here is, you know, a bit of a dissolve there, through to the man and the machine.
That's beautiful.
It's taking no time, is it? Bing, there he is. It's just keeping intent.
Well, you know, here he's totally focused. Here he comes up to the mechanic and he wants a bit of information, and he seeks the best way to get it instantly.
Not a camera on a sandbag?
I think that was a camera on a sandbag. Did a lot of sandbag in Mad Max.
It'd have been just outside the car, because in a moment it gets dropped.
That's right. On what the molly...
The molly what?
Yeah.
What the molly frock?
Molly frock.
Ah! What the crossfire!
I want to know about the tattoo.
I mind my own business, don't I? I mean, they'll kill me, won't they?
Why such a vintage car, John?
Was that your dad's car or something, John?
I think it was just something in the area that sort of made us think it would be good, because... you know, there's something about older vehicles that work, newer vehicles don't. Older things have a reliable quality.
A bit like film technicians.
Nowadays we can say that. In those days we probably just intuited it.
I had a red beard in these days, not a white one. Earlier on we had this shot where he opened the case and all his uniforms there. It reminded me of Cat Ballou.
Yes.
Where Lee Marvin opened the box and had all his fancy gear and his six-gun to go out and seek revenge.
Yes.
Is it where they're stealing the fuel?
I know. You know,
this is one of the first things we shot.
It was. I think it was on the first day, actually. Here he goes.
No safeties, no...
Nothing. Yep.
Unbelievable. And here they are, obviously siphoning gasoline.
Nick Gazzana, who's quite a famous musician in Melbourne.
Sure is.
Well, I'm not quite sure where their motorcycles were. And here we have Black on Black, the first time we see her in full glory. This is the ultimate police car owned by the Bronze. We still have polished styrene there on the back of the motorcycle.
Mm. I hope she had a face shot off, because...
What a great shot.
Mm.
Of course, the turbocharger there on the high-low gear ratio was totally fake. I hate to tell all those fans out there, but it was all fake. Okay, now this is the Mad Max beginning of the destruction of the Toe Cutters gang. Johnny the Boy. Here we are in a tracking vehicle on the actual crane arm high. Here we are, a camera mount, back to the tracking vehicle on the high crane angle, moving along the road. We're probably doing about 60 kilometres, 80 kilometres, and the camera's speed is enhanced to to make them look faster. That shot the wheel was probably the car stationary. All these stationary shots, that car could really move. So unlike the yellow police cars, it was able to do high speed. Here we are. These are under crank shots. Now, this was a real stunt that performed once. We have most of these guys were from the Vigilante Bike Club. This guy was really hit on the head. Fortunately, he stood up and after the scene and walked away. But there was no trickery there. They were done for real once. I think the slow motion enhancement. First shot, day one.
How many cameras? Oh, this, yeah, I remember this.
This was the first shot we did on the movie, day one, which was on the Geelong Freeway, just outside of Sunshine, I think.
And I think it was one take. That was it, and we had to move on because we were on the bridge illegally.
We didn't get permission. And didn't you have something to do with not having the key for the lock or something?
No, it was always meant to use the crowbar, David.
Was he? Okay, I'm not sure.
Was that a fake telephone, John?
Yes, it was totally fake. This was a zoom out from obviously a field. Here we have the black car. In pursuit. Now, I think that the tractor was there, or the semi-trailer was there, in order to slow Mad Max up, wasn't it? He couldn't get past.
Absolutely, that's its sole purpose. A fabulous graphic-looking thing. I'm sure we didn't pay anything for that more than a slab of beer.
The slabs of beer that were paid to people is amazing on this film. Should be called Mad Max the Slab. Mind you, there are certain parts in Australia that you can still get a lot for a slab of beer.
My memory is not all that good, but I believe we put this sign here, and it's a government prohibited sign, probably by the State Guano Department. And right here we've got a little setup where Johnny the Boy is playing possum, is playing dead, to set up Max.
Now, this car, this classic car, whatever happened to that?
I believe it's in a museum in the UK called Cars of the Stars, that somebody, I just heard that the other day.
It really, it's quite unique.
Yeah, it is totally unique.
I love that image with Mel and the telegraph pole.
That's my knee, and that hurt like buggery because I was making my own bullet hits and they wouldn't let me wear them on Mel.
Oh, that's very unfair.
And this is now Grant's arm underneath the road in a slot cut in the asphalt road.
Oh, I thought it was a leg. It was an arm.
Yep, for real. And Grant did that by cutting a slot in the asphalt road and putting foam underneath the slot and painting. Anyway, it was pretty horrific.
Quit toying, Bubba!
There's a city engineer somewhere that is looking for you.
There's a great stunt here where Bubba gets pulled off his bike.
That was a rope pull, wasn't it, I think? Yeah, they had a cable tied to him. There, you can actually see the cable very, very briefly if you look at it. That was before computer graphics where they could actually digitize the image and remove the cable.
I remember this day, I spent all day trying to get hold of that eagle, which we've just seen briefly on the fence.
What about the fly? See the jet streams up in the air? Sorry, and there's a fly around Hugh Key's berm. Why couldn't you get rid of the fly?
I don't know. We probably liked the fly at the time.
Jet streams.
And
here goes Huey.
Hugh's off.
You have to understand that all these actors actually rode their own motorcycles. It was unlike, apart from the occasional stunt, 98% of the riding was done by the actors. Now this is...
And that's a real sea eagle sitting on top of Bubba Zanetti's live body.
I don't think I've ever seen anybody stagger quite as well as Mel.
There's a lot of it.
Oh, but it's great. Look at it. It looks, you know.
So his kneecap blown off.
It looks very painful.
Another bird shot. Black on black. And here we have the toe cutter being pursued by Mad Max. And how was that, David? What were you doing there?
Well, we were probably doing about 160 kilometres an hour and with a rope tied around our waist.
I mean, who said we didn't have any fun doing it?
Well, I tell you what. We're on a tracking vehicle here on a crane up high. It's probably about 20 frames a second, 18 frames a second. That was a fixed shot on the road with a little bit of dolly. This is non-moving, rocking the vehicle. This is handheld over the shoulder of the driver. This is tracking vehicle from the rear. This is tracking vehicle from the front. Low, wide angle, probably doing 120, 160. They come screaming past. Here we are now. Here we come up to the... Now, if anybody wants to freeze frame, you'll notice that the actual bull bar at the front of a vehicle was painted by John Dowding on a sheet of steel, because the guy that owned the vehicle, no way, wanted to drive his truck over a motorbike.
And if you freeze frame on toe cutter's eyes, they bulge right out of his head.
Which was a prosthetic made sometime later and shot in the studio.
Absolutely, but it works so well.
Which shot was that?
Mel blinking and the whole, this sort of stuff. This sort of, well, he's driving through the night, driving, pursuing.
How does he know where to go?
It seems to be fairly random, his search.
Yeah, this is a trekking movie in many ways. He is pursuing the last of the gang, and I guess fate or leads him.
One telltale sign.
The wheels lead, the tire skids leading off.
And the camera in front of the vehicle?
The abandoned motorcycle. So obviously a bad deed has been performed yet again. But this is the end of it for Mad Max. This is the end of the gang that he's been pursuing.
I love this scene. It's where we really learn what could happen to any of us if we're pushed too far.
Hey, man. Oh, this isn't what it looks, man. You know, I just come down here to check it out, then. It's a guy. It's already snapped.
He sees an opportunity to revenge his friend, the Goose.
Angle. Okay.
In the same way. Remembering he's been shot in the leg, he's doing pretty good.
Pretty well.
Yeah.
His kneecap blown right off.
I remember Tim Burns saying, that really, really hurt.
It would have done too.
He's got a real handcuff around his ankle. He's being pulled by the wrist.
Hey, listen, man, will you... Listen to me.
Do you remember Tim saying that he remained handcuffed to the ute whilst everybody else went off and had lunch and left him there?
I don't remember that, but we probably did it intentionally, I think.
Yeah, more than likely.
I think we, like the toe cutter, had enough by the end. Is that coloured water?
Yes. Just that once, we used coloured water instead of petrol.
No, you used it when you cooked Steve Bisley too. It was coloured water.
Oh, we did, yeah.
Jesus, you can't kill me! Not for stealing a man's food. He was dead, for Christ's sake. I don't need him anymore. What are you doing?
Yeah, what can you say about the scene apart from his intensity?
All I can say is payback's a bitch.
The chain in those handcuffs is high tensile steel. It'll take you 10 minutes to hack through it with this. Now, If you're lucky, you could hack through your ankle in 5 minutes. Go.
You're mad, man. You think I look silly, don't you? Ha-ha! Don't bring it on me, man. Don't kill me.
This is the eponymous Mad Max shot.
And Chris Murray, piece de resistance. A perfect fireball.
It was indeed, and so brief. And it was zinc and sulfur as the driving agent, and dieseline and trichloroethane as the actual fireballing stuff.
But it was perfect.
Well. It was. Still
legendary, but brief.
Still weather.
Well, guys,
that's it.
I would like to thank and compliment everybody that was involved.
Absolutely everybody, yeah.
Especially us.
I got to tip my lid to the actors.
Yeah,
and having watched it again after so many years, it was all about them.
They're bloody fantastic, weren't they? What a bunch.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Excellent experience. The funny thing is that, I mean, you see each shot and we all know this is 4 years later. We can all remember exactly what happened every minute of every day.
Oh, I actually feel quite moved.
Well, I've got to say that as a special effects guy, it's a lot better than being an underground hard rock miner. And I'd recommend that anybody underground who's doing drill and blast have a serious consideration to getting into special effects, because that's what I did 23 or 24 years ago, and it's been a lot easier. And I'd recommend you do that.
Well, for me as a cinematographer and operator, it's I look back 24 years later and I think, wow, let's take a bull by the horns and keep doing it, because just for the fact that it was shot so 2 decades ago doesn't mean we can't do it again today. And the rawness and the crudeness of the film is also very warming and soul-searching.
Exactly. And I'd compliment that by saying, make it up as you go along, guys, because I'm still doing it, and might have a bit more backup nowadays, but you basically make it up as you go along, and that's what you do.
Yeah. Take the bull by the horns.